This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist. Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
This episode of the Sportsman's Nation is brought to you by Outdoor Edge and their complete lineup of replaceable blade knives, fixed blade knives, and game processing kits. Now, we've all been there before, trying to field dress your wild game with a dull knife. This is where Outdoor Edge really steps in. With the Razor Safe system, you can have a brand new razor sharp blade with just the push of a button. No more dull blades and no more problems processing your wild game. To check out all of the products from Outdoor Edge, visit OutdoorEdge.com. And at checkout, enter the discount code NATION30, that's NATION30, for 30% off of your purchase.
You're listening to the Average Conservationist podcast, brought to you by Go Hunt and in partner with 2% for Conservation. Sign up today to become an insider at GoHunt.com. 2% for Conservation's mission is to create an alliance of businesses and individuals that ensure the future of hunting and angling by committing their time and dollars to fish and wildlife. 1% of your time plus 1% of your money equals 2% for Conservation. 2% helps businesses and people pair with conservation causes to support things that fit what they care about. Whether you're into fishing, hunting, or just getting outdoors, 2% can help you not only start giving back to wildlife, but get certified for it. Getting 2% certified means you've made the same commitments as popular brands like Sitka, First Light, Stone Glacier, and Seek Outside in giving at least 1% of your time and dollars back to wildlife. But it's not just for outdoor companies. Breweries, contractors, coffee roasters, and even piano repair companies have earned 2% certification and stand out as leaders in their community for doing so. Businesses that are committed to conservation deserve your business when you shop. Learn more about 2% for Conservation at fishandwildlife.org. That's fishandwildlife.org. Fellow conservationists, welcome back to the Average Conservationist podcast, and I'm your host, Marcus Ewing. Today, this is kind of the long-awaited episode that I know many of you have been wondering about, waiting for. Well, the wait is over. Today, I am joined by the piano repairman himself, Brandon Robertson. I know you guys have, anyone who's listened to the podcast for any amount of time has certainly heard me reference piano repair companies. And we finally were able to make it happen. Brandon Robertson, the owner of Robertson Piano, him and I got to chat, and it was a super cool conversation. I mean, music is one of those things that everyone likes music, right? I mean, everyone has their own taste, which is, you know, a bit of an expression of individuality, if you will. But music is good, right? Like there's kind of no two ways about it. And talking with Brandon, I certainly got a deeper appreciation for his musical inclination. Brandon started off playing the piano at a young age. Music has been certainly a big part of his entire life, even through, you know, being an adult. And we get to talk about, you know, how he kind of got set down the path of tuning pianos to kind of pivoting a bit during the pandemic and now restoring pianos for people. You know, we talk about, you know, the piano being kind of this rather large kind of family heirloom that just gets passed down from generation to generation. You know, why, you know, for Brandon and listening to music, why it's, you know, probably a little bit different than it is for you or I with, you know, his training, the schooling, and just, again, his musical gift that he has. You know, he hears things differently, which I thought is just a super cool thing, because we all have that one thing, whatever that is, that, you know, we just have this deeper appreciation. We're just able to understand it a little bit better than most, maybe. And I think for Brandon, I mean, that's music is his thing. You know, we get to talk about how Brandon got involved in the outdoors later in life, and, you know, it became something that he wanted to be able to experience with his son as he got older, and really kind of, you know, change kind of the family culture, I guess, when it comes to the outdoors and, you know, how that's perceived, and, you know, bringing his son along with him when they do, you know, cleanups and things like that. So really fun conversation. I really enjoyed talking to Brandon. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this one as well. So episode 80. Brandon Robertson. Before that, I want to tell you about our friends at Stone Glacier. I know you guys have heard me talk about it a ton with some of the different packs that I use. The Avail 2200 is the one that I run primarily for really any type of kind of day hunting, turkey hunting, whitetail, what have you. But I like it so much that I actually have another one on the way that I'm just going to use for like my everyday carry, overnight trips, things like that. Like, it's just such a versatile pack, and there's so many great features about it that, you know, made me want to have a backup. You can obviously check them out at stoneglacier.com. If you haven't by now, check out the Stone Glacier app. You can get that on iTunes or Google Play, and you can order right from the app as well, and you can check out all the other cool gear that they have. You know, we're in the holiday season, so now is a great time to pick something up for the outdoor enthusiast in your life. You really can't go wrong with any of their products. So head over to stoneglacier.com. All right, joining me today is the owner of 2% Certified Robertson Piano, Brandon Robertson. Brandon, how's it going this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. It's going to kind of sound repetitive to you, because obviously we talked a few minutes before we started recording, but, you know, I've been indirectly mentioning you and your company really since the inception of the podcast. So to finally be able to get you on the phone and to talk a little bit more, I'm certainly excited about it. I'm glad we finally got you on here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. See, I remember I listened to a few episodes of the podcast, and I actually like paused it and went to the other room and was like, Gina, that's my wife's name, Gina. I told her, I was like, check this out. Plato was like, we're being talked about on a podcast. It's pretty cool.
No, that's awesome. I love the excitement and the enthusiasm and being proud of, you know, what it is that that you guys have built there. So I guess let's kind of set the stage a little bit here. Obviously, you know, the podcast is kind of centered around conservation, the outdoors. So tell me, Brandon, how was it that you were first really introduced to the outdoors?
I think that it's really just kind of been a side part of my life since I was real little. I mean, some of my best memories growing up are like camping with the family, you know, going fishing, stuff like that. And it's just always been kind of a part of my life. And I think that's true for a lot of people in Alabama. We just have like so much. I mean, it's like 70% forest or something. I mean, there's always some place you can go hang out. You know, growing up, we'd exit the subdivision and walk down the hill and go play in the creek. I mean, it was just something we always did. I don't think you could do that nowadays. My kid isn't allowed to go anywhere. I think we're all afraid that they're going to be taken away. But we used to roam the neighborhood, roam the woods growing up. And, you know, when I got older, I think really fishing was the thing that I stuck to the most. My dad got me a shotgun sometime, maybe it was close to junior high or something like that. And I, you know, ashamed to admit that I would go out and like shoot random birds. I don't even know what. I mean, at some point I've just sold the shotgun. I told my dad I wanted to deer hunt. He didn't do that. None of my family hunted or anything. So one night he was like, okay, just go sit out here in the middle of the woods. And I literally sat on the ground and like waited for a deer to come and nothing came. And that was my whole experience with that. I eventually sold the gun because it wasn't really anything I was using. But I don't know. Like I said, it's just always been kind of a side part of my life. And I mean, even in college, like something about the water, you know, going, you're stressed out or whatever, like even if you're not catching anything, like just being on the water, being near the water, like that's always been something that's been like the peaceful place, the happy place or whatever to go to. So I don't know if that answers the question exactly.
Yeah, no, for sure. And you make a couple points in there about your upbringing and your childhood. And I mean, I grew up the same way I lived in a small town, but I had woods kind of, you know, I could hop on my bike and ride for 2 or 3 minutes. And there was, you know, a patch of woods where me and the neighbor kids would go down there and build forts and, you know, just be kids in the woods. Right. And you're right. I don't know that I would let my kids today do the same things that I did growing up. I mean, obviously that was, you know, 30 years ago. Wow. I really just aged myself there.
Older.
Yeah. But it's different, you know, obviously now than it was back then. And it's very unfortunate, you know, because I would love to, you know, just let my kids, you know, roam around in the woods a little bit as long as I knew where they were at and that they were, you know, close to home. But, you know, back then, you know, we didn't have cell phones, so there was no way to like check in on us and stuff like that. I mean, if I wasn't home when I was supposed to, my parents would get in the car and, you know, kind of drive down the road to where they knew I was at and holler out the window, Marcus, you know, where are you at?
Right.
And, you know, I'd come stumbling out of the woods and, you know, get on your bike, come home, it's time for dinner, that type of thing. And it's a great way to grow up. And it's certainly a great way to kind of, you know, just have fun and really explore and kind of draw your own conclusions to the outdoors at a very young age, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the part that you mentioned about, you know, when you had a shotgun, you know, getting a shotgun. I mean, that was my first gun was a 20 gauge pump shotgun that I used. I received it probably when I was around the same age that you said you were, you know, middle school, somewhere in there, and, you know, did some bird hunting and some waterfowl hunting and stuff like that. And, those types of things are a great introduction to the outdoors and really kind of sparking, you know, a love and a passion for just the outdoors in general, whether you stick with hunting or, you know, like you said, the being on the water and just fishing and just kind of the peacefulness that it brings to you.
Yeah, definitely. My stepdad, he does hunt, and I can't remember exactly when he and my mom got married. I want to say it was sometime in, I don't know, maybe I was in seventh or eighth grade or something. And he bird hunts and, you know, has had bird dogs and stuff like that. And so that's always been neat to watch, but it's never been anything interesting to me. But I will say, like, I've always kind of seen it, you know, as something that somebody did. But I think his biggest contribution was really, like, he lived on a lake for a while. And so when he and my mom were dating, like, I would go up there and, like, take his boat and just go fish and stuff like that.
So what is the, I guess, tradition like for the outdoors in the South? Because, you know, I'm here in Michigan in the Midwest, and obviously there's a very kind of deep-rooted, tradition in the outdoors, especially, this time of year with deer hunting and stuff like that and deer camp and, you know, a way for people to spend time with friends and family. You know, I know a lot of people that go to deer camp that, you know, they don't even hunt. You know, they just like the camaraderie that comes with it, the, you know, kind of being with the guys or you know, for some, you know, sons or anything like that, you know, they get to spend time with their fathers and kids with their grandpas and all that. So what is kind of the outdoor traditions or, you know, what is that kind of scene like down in the South?
I honestly feel like I probably don't have a good handle on that, but I can tell you kind of what my impression is. Like I didn't start deer hunting until maybe 4 years ago or something. And that was just something I wanted to do because I wanted to learn how, so that I could have something to do with my son, because I'm like, I'm raising him in Alabama. There's a chance he's going to fall into something like that. And I know nothing about it. Growing up, I feel like probably everybody went to some lake or pond or something and fished at some point. But I feel like maybe the hunting is just kind of like if your family happens to hunt, then you do. If they didn't, then you don't. And I kind of felt like separate from the guys who did all that. I didn't really hang out with them. Don't know what their lives were like growing up exactly. My cousin is the one, when I was like asking around, like, hey, somebody please help me learn how to do this. I don't even know what I thought I needed to learn. I just felt like I couldn't just jump in and deer hunt myself. But I asked my cousin who I knew hunted, will you please help me? And I ended up going down with him to his hunting club where he grew up. And it was very much there's these stands and there's a feeder, you know, at the time, over 100 yards from the stand and just out of sight, because that was the law. Like, you couldn't see the feeder, but it's like everybody knew it was there and that's where you're aiming. And I guess that might be the tradition, is that people kind of had their own little cabins up there, little small trailers and stuff like that. And we all worked together on cutting, shooting lanes and, you know, planting food plots. And, I guess that's kind of what the people who did that growing up, I guess that's what they grew up doing. I mean, I've listened to some other hunting podcasts and stuff and kind of heard what different people do in different areas. And it sounds like it's kind of similar, at least everywhere, like Midwest to East. I don't know, in the West, it sounds like it's kind of a different animal, but, definitely the deer camp, the food plots, the, you know, tree stands that are there. I kind of quickly realized I don't like that. It bothers me, like, sitting still, knowing that there's a feeder right there, and just, oh God, I get so bored. So like, whenever I go down there with him, I try to find a stand that's away from everyone, where I'm just like looking at trees and sticks and stuff. It's more interesting to me.
Yeah. So what was that like for you, you know, picking up hunting at a later age? And, you know, I really like, you know, kind of the reasoning behind, for yourself wanting to get into hunting is, you know, wanting to be able to have some of those shared experiences with your son as he got older. So you mentioned that you reached out to a cousin who brought you to a hunting camp, excuse me. So what was that like? I mean, you know, from 4 years ago to now, you know, how has that process been for you?
Well, I feel like I should add too, it wasn't just to have something to do with my son. It was also the thing that you hear about a lot of people who get started later. It was also the kind of knowing where your food comes from. I mean, pre-COVID, I was kind of thinking, you know, as unlikely as it might be, there's a chance that, you know, the economy could fail and where am I going to get food, right? I mean, I'm not a prepper or whatever. I just was kind of like, what am I going to do for my family? Having a kid kind of makes you think about things like that you wouldn't have considered before, I guess. And so that was part of the reason too, is just kind of, I don't even know how to feed myself exactly. So that was it. But the four years ago or whatever it was starting, I saw one deer the entire year, and I can't tell you how many times I went out and tried. And it was a doe, and I had left my climbing stand by the car, and I walked down this path to kind of see where I wanted to put the tree up, because the climbing stand was so heavy I didn't want to carry it down if I wasn't going to go down there. And on my way back, there's a doe like standing right there. And I'm like, oh my God, there's a deer. And I pulled up the gun. I was shaking. I mean, if I'd pulled the trigger, there's no telling what I would have hit. But that deer, like, I was so shocked at how long it like stood there. Like, it's one of those things, I guess, you learn, like, when you start hunting, you learn things about these animals that you didn't know. But like, it's like, they can't really, really see, can they? It's just, it's interesting. And, you know, of course, I didn't shoot at her the next year. I guess I learned a little bit more, combined with, of course, having some luck. And my first deer I shot was I can't remember what you call it, but there's some kind of disease that can happen or whatever that causes a buck to remain in velvet after they're supposed to lose it.
Okay.
And so my first one was a 6-point little velvet buck, and man, I was so proud. It was cool. I would have it on my 2% page or whatever if I didn't fail to clean the blood up, because it's just, you know, a bloody picture with a big smile on my face. But it was a cool experience. And then after that, we get 3 bucks a year as long as one of them has 4 points on one side.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't know if you know this. Alabama gets a doe a day.
So, really?
Like, and our hunting season is from like the middle of October to the middle of February.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's insane. It's actually, my wife wishes it was much shorter, because since I've gotten into it, I kind of want to go every chance I can.
Yeah, I know how that goes.
But the... yeah, anyway, the next year I got those 3 bucks, so I bucked out, or whatever you want to call it. And then since then, it's been, you know, I'm not trying to get the biggest antlers or whatever, but I've enjoyed, you know, passing some of the younger ones on our own property to kind of be like, you know, I'm going to see if I can, you know, watch until they get bigger. And I've got cell cameras everywhere. I feel like I'm just kind of throwing myself all into this, and I love it. I've hunted some public land some. I've shot a couple of deer on public land, but it was like right off of my cousin's hunting club. Like,
okay.
It borders public land, so I'll like go with them to the hunting club and then like walk an extra 500 yards and be on public or whatever.
There you go. Yeah, no, for one, I knew that, like, you know, the hunting seasons in the South certainly ran later. I did not know about the doe a day, which is crazy to me to think how many deer that you could stack up over the course of a season. I mean, I got to imagine that people that are, you know, really taking advantage of that are, you know, not only, you know, filling their freezer, you know, 3 times over, but are also, you know, sharing a lot of that meat with friends and family, and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one of the cool things too, I didn't expect about hunting is, like the sharing, something like the pride of wanting to share the meat. Like, I don't think I'd ever like buy a pound of beef at the grocery store and like take it to a friend's house and be like, do you want this? But like, I've got some piano tuning customers who I've talked to a little bit, and they're like, well, I just love venison, you know? And I'm like, okay. And the next time I go, I'll bring them a little bit of cube steak or whatever. And that's cool. And then also, like, pre-COVID, at least, like, you know, I'd have friends over to grill a lot, and I'd, you know, share some tenderloins with them or whatever. And my freezer's actually still not full or anything, but it's still got a lot more meat than I usually would have at this time, because, you know, a lot of those things were kind of shut down. Like, friends didn't want to come over, nervous about getting sick and stuff like
sure.
that. And so I look forward to getting back to that more, because that's kind of a neat part of it. It was unexpected.
Yeah, it's what my friend Mark Haslam refers to as venison diplomacy, right? Being able to to share that with everyone. Like, it's, you know, I have, I would say almost the vast majority of my friends don't hunt. So we always do this guy's ski trip every year. There's probably about 5 or 6 of us. And, you know, we kind of like rent a cabin or whatever, and we'll bring a little grill, and everyone kind of brings some meat to grill up and stuff like that. So every year I'm bringing, you know, different cuts of venison. Last year I brought some steaks and some like bratwurst that I had, and they love it. I mean, it's almost like a treat for them, right? I mean, they maybe get it once a year or right. maybe twice if they have some other friend that, that hunts and wants to share some venison with them. But, it's really cool it's almost like very prideful, right? Like look what it's almost like I don't want to say like a humble brag, right? But it's like there's certainly like this proud feeling that you get with, you know, sharing, you know, your harvest, your venison, you know, even if it's not venison, you know, ducks, you know, upland birds, whatever the case is, to be able to share that with him and then tell the story, right? Because that's kind of my favorite part, especially when I get together with some of my buddies. It's like, yeah, this is how it all went down, right? Like before you eat this, like you have to know the story of this deer. And yeah, you know, whether they care or not, like it's always exciting to me to kind of give them a full picture of, you know, how this really came to be, you know, on the grill in front of them.
I may have taken that too far one time. I had some friends over and I was like, do you want to go see where this meat came from? Because I had the shoulder mount on the wall and everything. And I think that was a little bit weird for them. There's something about it being a little bit more abstract, me just telling the story, than like, here's the head of the deer where that came from. Anyway.
No, you should absolutely be proud of that. And I urge you to do that more often. Put people in uncomfortable situations like that. So let's kind of shift gears here. Tell me about Robertson Piano.
Well, I started off just, you know, tuning my own piano. I think it was 2001. People asked me when I started tuning, and I can't really give a date when I started tuning, and we could call it like a professional thing, but started on my own about 20 years ago. And then gradually, you know, tuned for friends and their acquaintances and stuff like that. And I moved into musical theater full time, doing production management and audio, like sound design, while kind of tuning pianos on the side here and there. But that eventually, I mean, being a production manager, anybody who does stuff like that, you know, there's really like your hours are just whenever, like you have to always be available. And, you know, that would become like 80 something hour weeks, and my son was going to be born soon. And it's like, okay, I got to shift. And 8 years ago or so, I shifted toward doing this full time. And I've kind of played around with rebuilding pianos and repairing pianos in addition to just tuning for a while. And I've really moved more toward wanting to kind of do custom rebuilds of pianos. And I've gotten into that some more lately, especially like with COVID, like, you know, my son's school closed and I'm like out of work because nobody wants me in their home to tune their piano. And so I started taking any shop work that would come. So I'm going to say that now Robertson Piano is probably focused a little bit more on piano restoration and customization than we are on tuning, though I still do that a couple of days a week. But I'm, you know, taking somebody's family heirloom piano and giving it a new look and a new life, so that when they hand it down, they're not handing down this piece of junk that doesn't really work for their grandkids to learn on. They're handing down something that's going to work for another 7,500 years or whatever. You know, in tuning, I see kids learning on instruments that are really pretty rough. So I don't know if you ever saw my logo. It's a clock with keys on it, and the idea is that my job is basically to help pianos last longer. So now I've got a shop where I'm doing storage, rebuilds, restoration, custom work, and also tuning. And my mentor, who's probably, I mean, it's hard to say because it's not like I travel everywhere, but I think he's probably the best rebuilder in Alabama, if not one of the top ones in the Southeast. And thankfully, he has moved his shop into mine, so we're able to do a lot more now. I don't know. I guess that kind of covers it. We just, you know, tune and rebuild and repair and try to make pianos look better and last longer.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting to me because, truth be told, so when I was in middle school, I was in band, I guess that's what they call it at that point. And I, was like, I want to play the drums, which apparently is the percussion. And I thought it was just the drums, but apparently you've got to learn like the bells that go with it. And then, you know, shortly after that, I was like, yeah, this isn't for me. Like, I don't have a musical bone in my body when it comes to being able to play an instrument. And I'm always super fascinated and impressed with people who just have this, you know, natural ability to pick up an instrument, you know, listen or watch someone play, you know, some chords anything like that, and then just be able to, you know, to repeat it, or to be able to just kind of, you know, if they have a guitar, you know, just be able to like riff on a guitar on their own. Like that's always just like something I really envy in people who are musically inclined, because I know that, you know, it may take years and years and years of practice for me to be able to even, you know, be on somewhat of the same level as someone who, you know, has done it for a year, right? So did you start playing piano then at a pretty young age? Has music always been a big part of your life?
Yeah, I started taking lessons when I was eight. When I was like three, I told my mom I wanted to play the piano, but somebody who taught locally said, okay, you need to wait till he can reach an octave, which is basically like reaching a C to a C with one hand, like a C to the next C up.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's bad advice for anybody listening. Please, if your kid's interested, just let them do it. But anyway, so I got a later start than I would have otherwise. And I took piano all through high school. I think senior year of high school, I was kind of bored with it and, you know, teenager, whatever. Like I decided that I was going to do something different for a year. And so I did music composition, like working on doing music on the computer and stuff, keyboards and stuff like that. It was pretty cool. And then when came time to decide on college, I ended up going into music composition. And then I have a master's in music composition, which I'm still paying for and ultimately not using, but it certainly led to a lot of interesting experiences, like a year as a exchange student in Japan, you know, of course, getting to learn how to do audio, which led to the musical theater stuff. I mean, I wouldn't change it for the world, but I had somebody, I think it was maybe freshman year or maybe it was right before I was going to college, talk to me because they'd seen me come in the piano shop a lot. It was the owner of the piano store, French Forbes. He said, you know, if you're interested in learning piano tuning, we can send you up to Steinway and you can learn some stuff there and then come back just in exchange for working with us for a while. And, you know, if you do it right, you can make six figures. And that was, you know, 20-something years ago. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, sure. And then I go get, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of college debt and finally ultimately end up to the pianos anyway. if I could change that, maybe I would go back and change that. But anyway, yeah, it's been an interesting life, always filled with music so far.
Yeah. Now, you said that you do like production management work. So is there a pretty big scene for like music and whatnot in the South? I mean, when I think of like music in the South, I think of a lot of like jazz, and maybe it's just like my mind always goes to like, you know, the scene in like New Orleans and stuff like that. And, you know, is there a pretty big scene for that in Alabama?
I mean, there are a lot of venues around here. I certainly am not an expert on kind of the music scene in general. What I mostly did was musical theater. And that was, you know, there's a regional theater here, Red Mountain Theater Company, that, you know, they continued to grow. And, you know, I'd say that musical theater for Birmingham size is probably pretty big, or at least getting back there. Everybody had a little bit of a pause for a while. But, I mean, there are bands that, There's some great venues here that bands come through to play at. Saturn, Birmingham Music Hall. I don't know. It's always been something in Birmingham that you could go do, but I don't know. It's not like Austin or something like that where, you know, they're just known for being a musical city.
Yeah. So you actually opened Robertson Piano like 20 years ago. Is that correct?
I would say I tuned my piano 20 years ago.
Okay.
Robertson Piano became official, like an LLC, maybe like 3 or 4 years ago. I started doing it full time about 8 years ago. So okay. I don't know when to say it really started, but it's gradually since 20 years ago.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned that you kind of got into like piano restoration and stuff. So kind of what does that process look like? You know, for one, like I can't even imagine, you know, what it takes to move a piano from someone's home I can kind of see my front door a little bit from my office here, and, you know, to try to get a piano in or out of my front door seems virtually impossible. So what is that, I guess, the whole process like from a customer bringing it in to getting it into your shop to, you know, doing the restoration? I mean, you know, what does the process look like? How long does that take?
Yeah, typically I hire a mover because I want to be able to walk when I'm 80, and pianos are very heavy.
Yeah.
But for a grand piano, they'll actually turn it on its side and put it on what's called a skid, and they'll remove the legs, and that's how it fits through the door, is basically on its side. And upright pianos are actually narrow enough that they can fit through a door too. Stairs and all that. I'll move. If there's zero stairs, I'll do it. I've got a loading dock here I can pull right up to. Mover company brings it in, sets it up. I get to work, like, taking everything apart, labeling, and then we start removing strings, taking the keys off, removing the action. And what I really like to do is have it refinished. I usually outsource that too. I'm actually doing one myself. We're spraying the finish today, but I don't like to because it's just not my specialty, and it takes me longer than it takes somebody else, so it's worth paying them. But we'll refinish the plate, make it look nice, restring it, sometimes put a new soundboard in, new pin block. But then I'll put in an action called WNG, Wessel Mickle Gross. It's really a modernized action that's unlike, in a lot of ways, it's unlike what typically goes in a piano. And, I mean, it's just great. Like, when you set it, it stays there. It's wonderful to work with. I really feel like more and more pianos are going to have that in it. But I love taking these old antique pianos and, like, kind of tricking them out with this modern action. And, then I'll add a player system to it. So, like, you could just get on your iPhone. You could even set them up sometimes where you can tell Alexa, hey, Alexa, tell piano to play Christmas music, and it'll do it. Like, that sort of stuff is so cool to me, to, like, take these pianos that may have been, like, one of those old scroll, stick a quarter in, and it'll play a song for you or whatever, and, like, make it, give it another 100 years of life, but, like, in a totally modern way. My dream would be if somebody would let me, like, do a chrome finish on their plate and, you know, I don't know, put some LED lights in there and, like, make it, like,
yeah, really, really modernize it.
Nobody's going to pay me to do it yet, but that's what I'd love to do.
Yeah, it's kind of like Pimp My Ride, but for pianos, which I like that thought. Now, how long does that entire process take?
Oh, man, it's 300 hours or so, maybe. Like, it's very time-consuming to do all that. Cause, I mean, you imagine, like, a piano built in the factory. I mean, they may be able to turn out hundreds a year, but they take months and months to do, even with all those workers. And here it's, like, me and Mike, who I told you, my mentor, basically. And every now and then he'll have some helpers come in because they're kind of, like, toying with the idea of becoming piano tuners, and they'll help some. But really, for the most part, it's me and Mike, and 300 hours takes a long time to get through when you're also out tuning. I've got one that's been in here. I told them it would be 6 months to 12 months, and I think I'm on month 8 right now. I've got another one that's been in here for about 3 months, and I believe I've got another 4 months on yet. So it takes a while. With more staff, obviously, it'd be quicker. But, it's a very involved process, but it gets you basically a piano that's like new or even better than new because of some of the technology that's come around since whatever piano was built.
Yeah, and I would imagine that as the process kind of goes, right, you kind of find different things that you can do to improve it. And the piano is one of those, like you say, kind of family heirlooms, so to speak, but it's one that gets used. I mean, when people think about something that's, you know, passed down from generation to generation, a lot of times, you know, it might be like a watch, right? Or something like that. Yeah. Like father gives a son a watch, you know, because it was given to him by his grandfather or his father. And, you know, a really nice timepiece, whatever. And that just gets passed down and passed down. But the piano it's a statement piece instead of, you know, on your person. It's a statement piece for your home, right? And it's something that people, I would imagine, you know, take a lot of pride in having in their homes.
They do. And, well, I'm going to say this publicly. This is like a joke between piano tuners, I guess. But, like, a lot of times people probably give their pianos more value, like way more value than they should. because of that quality. But I don't, you know, disparage them for that. It's just kind of funny because you tune in a piano that's like really should have already been sent to the junkyard, and people are so proud of it because it was their grandmother's piano. So, you know, you just do your best to keep it along until it really does completely die. But part of my mission in life is to either get them to upgrade or get that piano to last longer so that their kid's not trying to learn on a piano that really shouldn't be a learning instrument. You know, a lot of times people are like, oh, I don't need it to be that good because we're not a concert artist or whatever. And it's like, and you'll never be if you keep playing on that thing, you know.
So now when you're, you know, kind of pre-COVID, or I don't know if things have gotten a bit better down there now and people feel a bit more comfortable with coming into, having you come into their home and tune their pianos. But, you know, how long does, you know, tuning a piano take? I mean, is it something that's a couple hours, or is it, you know, a couple day process? I mean, you know, what does that look like?
Typically it's an hour, a little bit more to tune it. And then, you know, I always do more than just tuning. Just, you know, repeat myself, I guess, but just back to the trying to help the piano last longer. Like, I feel like there's things that rather than try to sell a tuning and then separately sell additional work to kind of keep the piano maintained a little better, I just like raise my prices above a tuning price, and I include that anyway. So I'll maybe clean the inside out, get all that dust out that's going to cause corrosion later, or I'll make adjustments to make it play better or voice it some to make it sound better, easier to control. Like, just there's a whole lot of things that can be done on a piano beyond tuning. So, you know, for me, a first visit is closer to 2.5 hours, and subsequent visits might be closer to 2 hours. But tuning itself is really about hour and 15 minutes.
Okay, that's not too bad. Now, as a piano player yourself, is there, you know, like a pianist or anything like that, that you've, you know, you've kind of always looked up to, or that you, you know, is kind of, I guess, from a playing standpoint, kind of like your idol, I guess, or someone you kind of aspire to maybe hope to be one day?
I may be unusual in this regard with pianists, I don't know, but there's a couple of guys that I follow and am really interested in, fascinated by their ability. That one is Mike Garson. He was a keyboard player for David Bowie.
Okay.
I didn't know this when I was first, like, kind of his fan. I don't know how I ended up coming across it, but there was this jazzy Christmas book that I bought randomly at a music store here in Gardendale once. And it was like my Christmas book for years. I still can't play some of the stuff in that because it's so hard, or for me at least. And he... like, there's a Nine Inch Nails song that I really like. I cannot tell you the name of it right now, but, like he's the pianist on it. I didn't know that until, like, in college or whatever. But, like, I always liked that song. I was like, man, that pianist is crazy. He's just playing this stuff that sounds wild. And anyway, that's Mike Garson. So I'm a big fan of his. He just does super cool jazz improv. And the other guy is Jordan Rudess, who's the keyboard player for Dream Theater. And, I mean, just... technical player, super good. I mean, just out of this world technical skills. And, you know, I do not have those. I have some, but, you know, certainly have lost some too as I've stopped playing as much. And I just really look up to those guys.
Yeah. So I'd imagine that, you know, just given your kind of musical background and that it's always been a part of your life, I mean, studying it in college and then, you know, your postgraduate work. When you listen to music, like, is that kind of the first thing that you're listening for is, you know, some type of, you know, keyboard, piano, some type of, I mean, just really kind of breaking the music down? Because I'd imagine, you know, really anyone that has a kind of, I guess let's call it musical intuition, right? They're able to kind of pick things apart when they listen to it. So is that kind of how you approach, you know, music and things that you're listening to?
I think once you, like, kind of become trained, like college-level trained or whatever in music, you can't help but hear pop music, stuff like that, differently. Like, I've never been, like, a words guy. Like, honestly, there are songs that are my favorite songs I still don't know the lyrics to. I just like the music and the sound of the instruments. And some of the stuff is so simple as far as the chords go. I mean, either people joke around, like, you learn five chords, you could play like half the country songs or whatever that people know. And that doesn't, I mean, it's not about that. Honestly, you listen to country music and it's a little bit more about the story. So like, so I get that, but like you hear, I hear it differently and I can't unhear that, you know, I can't just enjoy the music for its own sake on its own terms. I have to like, I hear the chords, kind of know what the progression is, stuff like that. I don't know if that adds or takes away, but can't help that. The stuff I like the most is, I mean, honestly, I'm probably weird as far as piano tuners go, but I like, you know, Tool, Korn, stuff like that, you know, heavy stuff. And mostly it's just the energy behind it, you know, the power, the sound. Like, I'm more interested in that, I guess, than the words and music. And I don't know if that's, I don't know, I guess I'm rambling now. You said don't worry about rambling, but...
Yeah, no, that, well, first off, when you mentioned one of your favorite pianists did, you know, played the piano on a Nine Inch Nails song, I was like, that's pretty interesting that, I don't, like, put the two together, right? When I think about, you know, Nine Inch Nails or even some of the bands that you just mentioned, like, I don't think of a piano, right? I think of, you know, bass and drums and, you know, just different types of, you know, kind of heavy hitting sound, so to speak. Right. And when I tend to think of a piano, I tend to think of, you know, a bit more elegant and, you know, just kind of a softer sound. But I certainly know that that's not, you know, the way that a piano is always played. Right. I know that you can, you know, manipulate it, you know, the keys and the chords and everything like that and create some pretty incredible sound from it.
Well, sure. And most of that stuff that I mentioned, like, they don't have piano. So I guess I just kind of like music in general. But yeah, when it is there, unfortunately, like, piano and rock music kind of died about 40 years ago or something, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, it's true.
I'm waiting for the comeback.
Everything's making a comeback these days. It doesn't matter what it is. Just give it some time. It'll resurface. Yeah, sure. So, obviously... Brandon, the reason that we've been able to sit down and get to talk here is that Robertson Piano is a 2% certified company. So how was it that you, being a piano tuner, learned about 2% for conservation?
Jared asked me that same question, and I don't know for sure. I know it was a podcast, but I don't know which one. You know, feeling a little lost in knowing what to do when I was starting deer hunting, as I mentioned earlier, like, I, you know, found podcasts to be a helpful way to kind of feed that a little bit. I mean, I don't know how much I've learned from them for sure, but I definitely, it kept me interested and kept me trying. And just one of the guys interviewed Jared for one of the podcast episodes. I listened to it and I was like, that'd be pretty cool. And I was at the time, like, kind of, I don't know how to put it, but I was like becoming more official. I'm looking into buying this building. I'm, you know, getting new bank accounts, like all of that stuff, forming an LLC, like all that process had me kind of look at my accounting differently. And, you know, I'm not really religious or anything. I don't have somewhere that I tithe to. But I do feel like giving is important. And, you know, I really ultimately heard about 2%, heard the interview, felt like, this is a good opportunity for me to honestly kind of force myself to do it, like, you know, stay accountable. Like, there's some organization that's going to look and be like, did you actually do it? You know, how much did you make? How much did you give? You know, so, and I have found it to be helpful. I mean, there are some months I'm kind of like, don't think about going and picking up trash on the trail or whatever. And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, it's been about a month and a half since I even did that, and I got to get my hours in. And, you know, when I hear some of the people you interview, I'm like, that's kind of sad. Like, I feel like those people are like, it's just part of their life that they just do it. And for me, it's not, like, it's something new to me, but you know, having that account, that thing that's going to hold me accountable, has certainly been helpful in making sure that I do my part, because I do ultimately feel so grateful for, you know, the ability to go and fish and hunt and all that, and just walk around, you know, these trails and stuff. And, you know, I don't know, I guess I didn't grow up, donating time or volunteering or giving money to organizations and stuff. And so the 2% thing seemed like a good way to keep me on track with that.
Yeah, no, that's a great way. And, you know, I think it kind of goes with, you know, the whole episode. And, you know, it's different, right? Like your reasoning behind it is different. I think ultimately, you know, the end reason or the purpose for doing it is the same, but kind of how you got there is different than maybe some other people who, you know, just grew up in the outdoors all the time. And, you know, conservation has been, you know, this kind of pillar in their life forever. But to look at it in that regard and say, you know, I'm getting, you know, more actively involved in the outdoors. You know, I realize, you know, the kind of fragile nature that is the outdoors, and you know how much you enjoy it, and you know wanting to be able to preserve that, and you know just finding a mechanism to help keep you accountable and to make sure that you know you're giving back, you know, at the same time as you know taking from the land with, you know, with hunting. I think that's a really cool way to look at it. And you know, I think that for anyone, whenever, you know, however they're able to keep themselves active and engaged, you know, whatever that method is, you know, more power to them, because it's, you know, it's not like this one size fits all model conservation, right? I mean, everyone practices it in different ways. You know, everyone's involvement is at different levels, but it's all like, it's all good stuff. Right, like anytime you're outside, and like you said, you know, like, you know, heading to the trailhead and picking up trash, or you know, going to your local waterway and cleaning up, or donating some time with an organization, like it's all good, right? Because, you know, the day before that trash was there, that next day it's gone, right? Like it's just making things, even if you know you look at it kind of in the grand scheme of things, you know, even if like just like the whole state of Alabama, right? Like if you picked up a, you know, trash along a, you know, a quarter mile stretch of trail, you know, that's, you know, and more and more people do that. I mean, that has a super big impact. And, you know, I certainly commend anyone that does that, you know, regardless of the reasons or motivations.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, like I said, I didn't grow up doing it, but I'm hoping that maybe I can pass this torch on a little bit to my kid, because he does join me on some of them. He may complain sometimes, but he'll join me on, you know, we'll make a deal out of it. Like, we'll go pick up trash around the bicycle trail, and then after that, we'll like take a lap, you know. But hopefully he's getting a little bit out of that, at least as an example, and he can follow that further, because you're right. Like, if everybody just did a little bit, it would be pretty amazing. But, you know, it seems like there's just a few people doing a little bit more.
Yeah, and I mean, you're absolutely right. Like with the reference that you made to your son there, there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, the more he does it with you, and the more he, you know, just kind of sees as he gets older, you know, your appreciation for the outdoors and why you guys are out there doing that, it'll almost just be one of those things that, you know, when the time, you know, he gets of age, like it's just natural, right? Like it's just, you know, when he gets to be, you know, our age, he can be like, yeah, I don't know. Like I grew up, you know, picking up trash and, you know, trying to take care of, you know, the lands where my dad and I hunted. Right. And then, you know, you're almost creating like this shift, you know, in your family and in the outdoors as it pertains to your family, with how you look at it and how you treat things.
Yeah, totally.
So what are some of the organizations, that you're giving back to there with Robertson Piano?
I started off Alabama Water Watch. They're a volunteer, like a citizen volunteer water quality monitoring program. That's a mouthful, but basically they, people volunteer, they learn how to do water tests with, you know, various chemicals in a kit that you could buy specifically for them. And you adopt a location and you do your water tests, you know, hopefully regularly, and that information goes on the website. They're part of Auburn University, which I don't know how involved they are at Auburn University, but you know, that stuff is public. Like, all the records are public from all the water tests, and people use them in various ways, whether it's like to find out, you know, what kind of disturbances might be happening in the water, like if the oxygen levels seem to be low over a certain period of time, then maybe there's something upstream, like a development that's letting runoff, you know, into the creeks, or there's, you know, some plant or whatever, you know, up somewhere dumping chemicals or whatever. Like, that information can be used that way, but it's also used, you know, just by people doing studies of water over time. Like, they'll take the records and, you know, professors might use it for whatever research project they got going on. So that's one thing I did was do some of the water testing. But, you know, over time, over these few years I've been a member, I've kind of, like, moved into other things that might be a little bit more interesting to me. I mean, Freshwater Land Trust probably is the one that I give to the most, both time and money. They help people with, like, get conservation easements on their property. They'll buy property to do that. They're basically protecting land around the Birmingham area and the surrounding counties. I mean, they've done some really cool projects or helped other organizations too, like do some projects. There's one like Turkey Creek Nature Preserve, which is just, you know, a beautiful area that might otherwise be bought and turned into a subdivision, but they've got it, you know, blocked off with conservation easements, and, you know, multiple organizations kind of came together to do that. It was like one of those public-private partnership things. And there's another thing kind of recent, I want to say it was like 15 years ago or so, it was created Red Mountain Park here. It's just another place with, you know, trails and stuff like that that people can go to. And just people from all over Birmingham will go there and walk around. And it was I hope I'm not wrong about this, but I think it used to be like a large, like, U.S. Steel owned property or something, and they worked with Freshwater Land Trust to create that park and sold it to them like at a major discount, and, you know, all that stuff. So they're doing good stuff all around. They've even started most recently, their project is connecting different paths, whether it's a sidewalk or like a greenway trail or something around Birmingham and out to all the towns and cities around. I mean, I think their ultimate goal is to, like, have 200 miles of greenways, like, connected by, like, 600 miles of sidewalks, bicycle trails, stuff like that. Like, I mean, Gardendale, for instance, is like 15 minutes north of Birmingham, which is where Freshwater Land Trust is based. And we've got a trail here, and then there's a city even further north that's got a trail, and they're ultimately getting it to connect. So, like, there's just miles and miles long trail that you could basically start in downtown Birmingham and walk or bike or whatever, and it's all done by them. So I really, really love what they're doing. So I've been, like I said, we basically became a corporate partner, which is kind of funny to think of my little company as a corporate partner, but that's what we're doing. I've also, like, that was kind of like at the beginning, I'm like, well, what are my customers going to think if they go online and they find out that I hunt deer? Like, are they going to be weird about that? Like, it's not, I mean, I hear Jared talk about, like, people's, you know, companies joining because their customers and they consider conservation that important. And I feel like that is true for Sitka or somebody like that, you know?
Right.
But for me, I don't think people could care one way or the other. I really mostly do it, like I said, to hold myself accountable. But I did start, like, I bought one of those Conservation Crossing t-shirts that Public Land Tees was selling.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep.
So, ended up joining like five organizations, and the National Deer Association, I joined them, and joined Quail Forever. And it's just been kind of fun, like, because now I've got like money. I literally have a bank account called Giving, right? So like my money comes in, and then each twice a month I like split it up, and, you know, a certain percentage goes in the Giving account. So now it's like, I'd like to, you know, give a couple $100 to this group. I mean, Mississippi State Deer Lab. Like, I sent them $100 one time. Like, it's small stuff, but it's fun to, like, see somebody doing something that you want to support and just be able to, like, give. So I would say mostly Freshwater Land Trust, but there's really, like, a whole bunch of different organizations I've given just a little bit to here and there.
That's quick shout out to Sam Soholt. He's been a guest on the podcast, the Conservation Crossing, the what do you want to call it? The the project that he did with that was super cool. And I'm sure that him and his brother Josh, who own Public Land Tees, which is also a 2% certified brand, raised a lot of money for a lot of different organizations there. And that was super cool. I remember actually when I had him on, it was right before he had announced that. And he couldn't tell me about it on air, but when we got done talking, he was like, yeah, I'm going to make this t-shirt and I'm going to sell it for $100 and you're going to get, you know, 4 or 5 memberships out of it and you're going to get a t-shirt. And I told him, like, you know, Sam, if anyone's going to get someone to just pay $100 for a t-shirt, like, it's going to be you with everything that he's done with the Stamp It Forward and just the Public Land kind of tour that he did with the bus and the van. I'm like, you won't have a problem selling those t-shirts. And it, you know, it by all accounts, it appears that it was another successful project that they put together over there.
Yeah, it's a super cool idea. And it was, I don't know, it was fun to do. And, you know, I think my renewal is coming up about right now for all that stuff. And I may not renew each of those, but, you know, I decided to instead of Pheasants Forever, join Quail Forever, which I think is the same organization, but just my stepdad's a quail hunter and we have like 10 acre field where they do that. And so, you know, it was like an intro into continuing some of these memberships. I'll certainly rejoin Wild Turkey Federation and Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and there's all those various ones that came along with it. I mean, it worked beyond the t-shirt, because now it's kind of like, once you're in, for the most part, people tend to renew.
Yep.
So I'll be one of those people too.
yeah, absolutely. And what I really liked about kind of your approach to giving back was, you know, as you've gotten further involved with conservation, you've kind of picked or found kind of your niche a little bit and things that you're passionate about, things that, you know, you can kind of have a direct impact on, especially there in Alabama. And that's one of the things that I really like about, you know, hearing people's story is, you know, they find out, you know, what they're really passionate about. And they're, you know, I feel like you almost have a bigger impact when, you know, your focus is a bit more narrowed, or your approach is a bit more narrowed in terms of who you want to work with and who you want to give back to, because you don't stretch yourself too thin. And I don't mean that in a negative way, because, you know, joining, you know, different organizations is great, and the membership fees and any donations you make are certainly important for helping those organizations achieve their mission. But, you know, if it's something right there at home, you know, not only your money, but the time and the work that you can actually do right there on the ground is certainly invaluable.
Something I don't know where this fits or whatever, but something that just came to mind is, you were talking about the opportunity to share, you know, if you have a doe a day, right? The opportunity to share that meat so broadly or whatever. I don't think we have a very well developed, like, feed the homeless sort of thing. I don't know. I can't remember, Hunters for the Hungry or whatever, like whatever those organizations are called. We have something sort of, but it's not very broad and there's not very many people involved. I don't know if there's anybody who's going to listen to this that has an idea about how to further develop something like that. But I tell you, that is something that I would certainly want to do, because it's a win-win situation. I mean, like if I shoot 3 does and 2 bucks, I'm basically going to have a freezer that's too full, we can't eat it all, right? But if I have the opportunity to shoot as many does as I want, I can go hunting whenever I want, and I know it's going to go to a good cause, and that's going to be true for any other hunter in Alabama. Like, I really would love to get something like that going, or get whatever is there, you know, growing further, so that more processors are involved and stuff like that. I guess I'll just take this opportunity to say that, in case there's anybody around here or anybody in another state that knows, you know, please reach out to me, because that's something for sure that I have an interest in, is trying to figure out how to get something like that.
Yeah, no, and that's, I think that that's a great idea. And I know that there's certainly some organizations out there like that. And I don't know a ton or really anything about how they operate, where they operate, any of that, but it's certainly, you know, a way for us as hunters to, you know, not only give back to people in need from a food standpoint, but to, you know, potentially you know, open the eyes to some people who maybe have never really tried wild game, right? And give them an opportunity to have, you know, clean, lean protein, and, you know, kind of give them the opportunity to, you know, experiment with it when it comes to cooking and figure out, you know, how they like it and everything like that. And, you know, maybe spark an interest for them to be, you know, a hunter or an angler, or any of the above, and, you know, get them involved in the outdoors as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Brandon, I see we're coming up on about an hour here. So, I just want to ask you one more question before I let you go is, I know, this is something that I kind of ask everyone is, do you have, any hunting trips or, fishing trips or anything like that kind of planned out here in the future that you're excited for, that you're looking forward to?
Well, our rut is in the area where I live in. I don't know if people are familiar with Alabama, but we imported deer from like all over the place at some point decades ago. And so, like, depending on what part of the state in, you can have a rut, like beginning of November or whatever, like most of the country. And then you can, like, I think on my parents' land, it starts up in a couple of weeks, you'll start seeing scrapes everywhere. Actually, on one of my cell cams, I got a big guy who I'm pretty excited about. And if actually I'd been hunting this morning, he would have been right by where I would have hunted according to the wind.
My apologies.
Anyway, it was 6 a.m. So missed opportunity, but still that lets me know he's around. So that's cool. So I'm certainly looking forward to our rut, which is coming up, and everybody else is kind of like, well, I'm done. I didn't fill my tag. I'm like, come to Alabama or don't come to Alabama. I don't know. Like we have rut. I mean, depending on where you are, you really can't hunt the rut until February. So like, you just hop around the state and constantly be involved in like in deer, you know, being dumb. And the only thing is, like, I feel like it's probably different than a lot of places, like as far as the rut goes. I have yet to see more than one day of that craziness that people talk about, like where deer are just like all over the place blowing and chasing and stuff like that. I saw that one day once. Maybe that's about as often as anybody sees it. So maybe it's not different, but.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. Well, I remember when we first started corresponding through email there, you're like, well, if we could do it, you know, either, you know, like late November or like the first week of December, that's going to be good. He's like, you said that'll be better because the rut's coming and you're going to be pretty tied up. So no, I'm certainly glad that we were able to make this happen. And, you know, obviously I wish you, you know, nothing but success with the business. And then also, you know, trying to put a big guy on the ground here in the next month or so.
Thanks so much, Marcus. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Hey, one more quick question. Obviously, last week, I don't know if you're a football fan or not, but obviously last week was the Iron Bowl. So are you an Auburn or an Alabama fan?
I am one of those rare birds in Alabama that didn't grow up watching football, and I couldn't care less. But my wife is an Auburn fan, so I guess by connection, I am an Auburn fan.
Yeah, War Eagle. There you go. All right, Brandon. Well, take care of yourself, man, and thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks again, Marcus. Take care.
Yep. Okay, well, thank you again to Brandon for joining me today. I would like to thank the partners of the podcast, Wild Rivers Coffee, Stone Glacier, and Go Hunt. Be sure and go out and support the companies that support this podcast and help make it possible. I would also like to thank 2% for Conservation. And if you're interested in learning more about 2% for Conservation, you can visit their website, fishandwildlife.org. And over there, you can see all the certified brands that have committed to conservation that you should support when you shop. I encourage you guys to follow 2% on social media as well, where they're going to post only positive conservation-driven content, so you'll certainly enjoy that in your feed. So again, if you'd like to learn more about 2% for Conservation, you can look for them online on social media or at fishandwildlife.org. Thanks for joining me this week, everyone. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Stay tuned next week, and remember to stay safe out there, and conservation starts with you.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.